Hey guys, this is Beth Golay. And before we get started with Marginalia, I just wanted to say that KMUW's podcast platform is made possible by High Touch Technologies, a software technology and business communications company that provides products, services, and support to all industries. High Touch brings the human touch to technology with a world-class team of industry experts. Learn more at hightouchtechnologies.com. And now, here's Marginalia.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia, notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental or additional to the main topic
in the margin of a book.
Randall Monroe is the creator of the website XKCD and the author of the books What If, Thing Explainer, and his latest, How To, Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. I recently visited with Monroe about the site and the books, both of which have millions of fans, and Monroe's trajectory from a NASA roboticist to a full-time internet comic strip creator. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. I wanted to start by asking you about XKCD, because millions of fans go to your site every week, but for the 10,000 that might be learning about you for the first time today, according to the formula provided in the book, can you give them an overview about your website?
Sure. It's a comic that I publish three times a week that started off as doodles that I did in my notebooks while I was studying to get a physics degree in university. And at some point, I started scanning in those notebooks just so that I'd save the things I drew in them before they fell apart and put some of them online, and was sort of surprised when people started sharing them around and reading them. And so I started posting more of them.
And when did you start posting them online?
That was in the fall of 2005.
But you left NASA in 2006 to do this full time. It really took off then, didn't it?
Yeah, I was sort of surprised by how quickly that took off. I started working at NASA. I had worked there over the summer at a student internship, and then the next year got a job in a robotics lab. And I was working on doing navigation algorithms for robots. And I was working there on a contract basis. And so at the same time, you know, I was posting my drawings online. And then at some point, someone said, hey, I want to get a T-shirt with one of your comics on it. So I put up a little store where people could buy T-shirts. And before I knew it, I was kind of spending all of my free time shipping T-shirts to people. And I reached a point where I felt like I had to decide if I wanted to keep going into work on robots or if I wanted to draw my comics full time. And it was around the time that one of my contracts ran out, so instead of like looking for a new one, I just thought, well, I'll give this internet comics thing a try.
Do you miss working with robotics?
I don't know. I think one of the great things about comics is that I get to kind of jump from one topic to another, especially, you know, as anyone who's worked on any kind of an engineering or complicated project can appreciate, like, I felt like it was cool working on robots, but still, like, 90% of my time I spent, like, trying to figure out why this one thing that should work didn't work, you know, going through like trying to find, okay, one thing in here is broken, where is it? And I would spend all day debugging that. And I think that can be really fun. But one thing that I've really enjoyed is that I really am so easily distracted that I'll be working on a project and then something else will catch my attention and then I'll start working on that instead. And when I, you know, with a lot of jobs, that is not okay because you have a thing that you need to finish, and that is your thing that you're working on. And with comics, I think I've discovered a way to, like, work on something cool, work on it long enough to find out a funny, punchy thing that I can draw a comic about, post that, and then move on to the next topic.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about your books, because they've all had slightly different premises. What If, the subtitle is Serious Scientific Answers to Absurd Hypothetical Questions. And did this come from your blog, from people submitting those questions on your blog and you put them into the book?
Yeah. One thing that I found is since I did comics about these science topics, people would occasionally write into me to like try to settle a dispute they were having with a friend. You know, if you threw something at Superman at the speed of light, but he could see it coming, could he, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they would always say something like, we didn't know who could settle this, and it seemed like kind of too silly a question to bother a real scientist with, but we agreed you might be a good person to ask. And I feel like getting asked a really interesting question like that is sort of like getting a song stuck in your head where even if I weren't going to write back or wasn't going to do anything with it, like I want to know the answer. So I would, before I know it, I've spent like 6 hours reading about, you know, whatever topic they were asking about, trying to figure out if I had the answer right or not. And then when I finally got to an answer that satisfied me, I would write up a whole long explanation of it. And then I realized at some point that I was putting a lot of effort into, you know, answering random questions now and then. And hey, I could post these online. Maybe other people would like to read them too. So I set up a section on my website where people could send in their questions and I would try to answer them.
Well, and then another book you published that I just really loved was Thing Explainer. And the subtitle is Complicated Stuff in Simple Words. And you took sophisticated works and broke them down into simple illustrations and words. You limited yourself to 1,000 of the most commonly used words in our language. That one was geared for like ages 5 to 105, if I remember right.
Yeah. People always ask me, you know, what age are these books good for? And the truth is, I don't really know anything about kids. Like I'm like, I don't know. Put the book in front of them. And if they pick it up and start reading it, I guess it's a good age. And if they try to eat it, maybe wait a few years. So Thing Explainer, it was a book, you know, where I took a whole bunch of things. You know, I did Saturn V rocket that took people to the moon and the inside of a cell and a bunch of other cool pieces of machinery or planets or just anything that it was fun to do a complicated diagram of. And then I tried to explain it using only the 1,000 most common words. And part of what inspired me there was when I was little, I really liked those like fold-out charts that would show how, you know, the space shuttle or an oil rig worked, where they would be so intricate that you could sort of sit there and browse through it for like hours looking at little details. You know, like, oh, hey, there's a little person looking out of the window here. And, oh, I never knew there was a room down here where this happened. And, you know, and that, exploring that kind of stuff is so much fun. And I feel like I still like exploring those complicated diagrams. And I wanted to make something that would be fun to go through in that sort of way.
Well, and so now this latest book is titled How To. And you started off by saying in the introduction, first line, that this is an entire book of bad ideas. How did you come up with this, you know, with this tangent, a how-to book in which solutions begin with the obvious, but then move to the absurd?
I feel like I come up with bad ideas the same way I come up with good ideas. I just discard the other half. I feel I'm always coming up with bad ideas for things, especially when there's a task where there's like a simple way to do it, but it's kind of repetitive or it's going to take a while. I'm one of those people who's always thinking, oh, wait, I have an idea that, okay, this is going to take a little bit more time now, but in the long run, this will actually save time. It'll, you know, just wait and see. And typically I'll be still working on just getting that working by the time everyone else will have just finished the task by doing it the boring way. So it's often, maybe usually not, you know, my ideas are not better. But one of the things that's fun is I'll often learn something that then later on helps me solve another problem in a more straightforward way. And so with How To, I sort of took simple tasks, many of which there's a really obvious way to do. And then I just tried to think, what are some other ways you could do this? Maybe making use of interesting science or interesting engineering ideas. And then what would happen if you tried them? And then I get to go through, why are they a bad idea? Or maybe do any of them turn out to be good ideas? And in either case, I look at like why that is and what cool stuff you can learn along the way.
Yeah, because the advice, even though you say in the subtitle that, you know, it's absurd scientific advice, everything is scientifically sound, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, for the most part, yeah. The advice is all scientifically, you know, sound, but maybe not sound in any other way. Like, technically this would work, but for obvious reasons you wouldn't want to try it. It could be another subtitle.
Now, I counted about 34 how-tos. I mean, I think there were 28 numbered, but then there were some sub-how-tos in there. You know, anything from making an emergency landing to making friends. One chapter was prompted by a question from Jay Mooney, how to play the piano. And first, I want to ask, what was the question? And then maybe you can give some insight into the thought process for that how-to.
Oh, yeah. So he had sent in a question, this reader, about playing a piano and what it would be like playing a piano whose keys went further in either direction, which got me thinking about all of the interesting, you know, ultrasound and infrasound science out there and learning more about that. And I realized that could be a really good way to talk about sound and the whole range of frequencies that humans and animals can hear and using this extended piano as a metaphor, you know, as an explanatory tool. So I talked about how to play the piano, but it's really about how to play, like, what kinds of interesting stuff you can hear and what kinds of stuff, sounds you can play if you extend beyond the normal spectrum that people can hear.
Well, I also loved the notes that were on the staff that, you know, if you put your whole arm on the piano, that made me laugh.
For a lot of these chapters, I'm writing about something where there's a simple and obvious way to do it, and it's not necessarily something that I know how to do. So I wrote the How to Play the Piano chapter, and I can, like, carefully pick out Twinkle Twinkle Little Star on a piano. And I managed to write an entire chapter on how to ski, still having never put on a pair of skis in my life.
So I understand that Serena Williams is a fan, and I understand that she helped you with one of the chapters?
Yes, that was one of the coolest, biggest honors in writing this book, was I had a chapter on how to catch a drone. And it's sort of about, you know, those wedding photography drones that you'll see flying around. And sometimes you're like, who's flying that? I don't like it here. I wish it would go away. And there are all kinds of different, you know, things people have come up with for how to, you know, shoot down a drone or how to catch a drone with a net gun or interference or a jammer or something. But I wanted to think about if you could just throw stuff at it, if you were just using sports equipment, what would be the best choice? So I found a bunch of research on accuracy in different sports, because I was wondering, you know, it seems like probably a baseball pitcher would be better than a basketball player at hitting a drone. But on the other hand, the basketball is much larger, so you have a little bit more margin of error where you don't have to get it quite as close to the drone to hit it. And I was wondering who would win out. And so I started getting research on how accurate people were at throwing different kinds of projectiles. I looked at, like, you know, football quarterbacks, who are actually really surprisingly accurate, versus baseball pitchers versus hockey players. And I found sports science studies on each of these showing how good they were at hitting targets. But at one point I noticed that I didn't have any data. I didn't find a good study on tennis players. You know, I'm sure there have been ones out there, but I couldn't find one in my searching. And at the same time, I had gotten a message and was going to send a note to Serena Williams and her husband. And so I mentioned that I was working on this tennis chapter. And to my surprise, they were like, hey, if there's any way we can help out, we'd be happy to. And so I said, oh, well, of course, you know. And I figured that she's, you know, Serena's very busy. And so I was like, okay, if you could just, during practice, like, just put up a target on the wall somewhere and serve a few tennis balls at it. And just tape, like, how close they hit, so I can have good accuracy data from, you know, the greatest tennis player alive. To my surprise, not only were she and her husband both very enthusiastic, they went above and beyond and, in fact, got an actual drone and flew it out over the tennis court and then had Serena serve at it until she hit it and confirmed that a tennis ball hitting a drone will absolutely knock it out of the sky. It was very impressive. And she got it in fewer tries than the model I had put together predicted that she would.
Yeah, didn't you guessed that it would, you know, I'm trying to think, it was like between 5 and 7,
yeah,
or 5 and 9, or and she got it in what?
In general, sports where players hit things with another object, like hockey or tennis, tend to be a little bit less accurate than things where people throw, but can be more accurate than sports where people kick. And so I had come up with an estimate at that distance with that particular model drone, it would probably take her 5 or 7 serves to hit it, but she got it on the third try.
That's incredible.
I guess that you should never underestimate Serena Williams. She did mention that she was initially unable to hit it because tennis players can't serve straight up. So if you're going to use a tennis racket as an anti-drone weapon, you should try to arrange it so that the drone will be near the same level as the server. She also said that she did not think it was a very good approach overall. Well, I got to agree with her on that one.
And she then she felt bad for the drone, if I remember right. And I was wondering if as a former roboticist, if you could identify with that.
Yeah, I felt sort of bad, too, especially because they sent me a picture of the drone lying there on the tennis court after it had been knocked out of the sky and it had little fragments of propeller around it. The drone was actually repaired. Its camera had already been broken, which is why they chose to sacrifice it for this. But with a new propeller and a little bit of patching up, it was back and flying. It went to a family member. But yeah, I was like, it does feel kind of mean, like to hit a drone, which is silly because it's just a toy. But I ended the chapter by reaching out to Kate Darling, who's a robot ethicist at the MIT Media Lab and studies like how people interact with robots. And so I got to ask her, you know, do you think this is okay? Should we feel bad? And she said that, you know, of course, drones don't have feelings. You don't have to feel bad about that. But the way we treat robots as they become more lifelike does kind of reflect on us, and it might affect how other people see us. So that's a reason not to be too mean to robots, because if people see you being mean to a robot, it sort of gives them the sense this is the kind of person who likes being mean to things that seem alive. And that might be something worth avoiding, even if the robot doesn't care.
Now, I wanted to mention one last chapter, and it's chapter 24, How to Win an Election. And I'm bringing this up because you brought up a race that occurred in 2018 for the Kansas House of Representatives. And it was Congressman Ron Estes ran for re-election, and mm-hmm. he was challenged in the primary by a political newcomer who was also named Ron Estes. I live in that district. That happened right here.
Oh, nice. Did you hear from anyone who was confused on the ballot?
Yes. I mean, we have a news department here at the station, and we did a lot of stories on it. So, yeah, absolutely. It was, when I saw that, I'm like, oh, my gosh, he wrote about the Ron Esteses. So that was kind of fun.
My favorite thing about that, well, that you might appreciate from being from that district, was that I included a district map showing the results by district. And, you know, I got the results from the Kansas Secretary of State's office to construct that map to know, because I colored in the ones won by one Ron Estes, one, you know, dark, and the other Ron Estes light. But what I noticed when I was trying to look at other maps to make sure I had gotten it right, the New York Times website has results for that primary, except they show 100% of the votes being won by one of the Ron Esteses and 0% by the other.
Huh.
I think because of a glitch caused by the identical name.
I will have to look into that. That's funny. So, do you have a favorite chapter in this book?
Well, I don't know. I'm really torn, but I think my favorite chapter ended up being chapter 5, which is how to make an emergency landing. Because for this chapter, I had the idea of, you know, I'm not a pilot, but I thought it might be fun to reach out to Chris Hadfield, who's a former test pilot and also commander of the International Space Station, famous for, among other things, playing a David Bowie song on the International Space Station. And so I thought, okay, he's an astronaut, test pilot. I'm going to ask him about landing in as many weird scenarios as I can. And my goal was to just keep asking him about stranger and stranger landing situations until he got like lost his patience and just like hung up on me when I asked him something too ridiculous. And boy, was I in for a surprise, because he just answered every question that I asked with no hesitation. You know, I started off with what I thought was a kind of silly question, but, you know, not too silly, but it was, you know, okay, I know this is kind of a strange question, but if you were coming into land, but there was no runway and no open spaces of any kind except for farmers' fields, which crop would be the best to land in? And he just immediately launched into like, well, that's not a silly question at all. When I fly small planes, I think about that stuff all the time. You know, when you're driving into the airfield, you look around and see how high are the beams? Have they brought in their hay yet? You can't land in a muddy field, so you got to look out for rain. And then went out to lay out like which crops were better for landing at which times of year. And that's when I knew I was, I might be in trouble here. And I just kept getting stranger and stranger. And in every case, with every question, he just answered it very simply and always in that like deadpan air traffic control astronaut voice. So he just described, like, if you're trapped on the outside of a plane, here's how to crawl around and use your weight to steer. And if you're going to crawl back to the tail, here's how to grab onto the flaps and steer it. But he's describing it as if, oh, yeah, I've done that 1,000 times. And so I ended up just printing the interview with him and just illustrating his answers because there was just nothing I could add to them. And I'm still delighted with how that one turned out.
Did you finally just throw up your hands and say, okay, you win?
Yeah, I actually had a question saved up that I thought was too silly and I wasn't going to ask it. But then I ran out of all my other questions and I said, I know this is outside your area of expertise, but what would you do if you were picked up by a rock, the giant mythical bird? How would you try to force it back down to the ground without dropping you? And he just immediately says, well, I think your best bet is probably to treat it like a big angry hang glider. Because if you pull your weight to one side, the rock will have to turn in that direction. If you can somehow get your weight forward, it'll have to dive. So you could sort of steer it if you're strong enough. And then Nate started laying out, you know, but you don't want it to get mad at you and drop you and you from too high. And then he said, well, you know, maybe you should be psychological. What does it want? Do you have food? I think you're better off if you can't use your own weight against it, then use your psychology and intellect. And I don't know what motivates a rock. And I just love that the commander of the International Space Station weighed in on the motivation of giant mythical birds.
That was Randall Monroe, author of the book How To, Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems, which was published by Riverhead Books. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at kmuw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Goulet.